Abe Lincoln said the philosophy of the schoolroom in one generation will be the philosophy of government in the next. So when you eliminate the word of God from the classroom and politics, you eliminate the nation that word protects. America is now number one in teen pregnancy and violent crime, number one in illiteracy, drug use, and divorce. Every day a new holocaust of 5,000 unborn die, while pornography floods our streets like open sewers. America's dead and dying hand is on the threshold of the church, while the spirit of Sodom and Gomorrah vexes us all. When it gets to the point where people would rather come out of the closet than clean it, it's the sign that judgment of God is going to fall. If there's ever been a time to rise up, church, it's now. And as the blood-bought saints of the living God proclaim, that it's time to sound the alarm from the church house to the White House and say, we want God in America again. I believe it's time America to stand up and proclaim that one nation under God is our demand. And send this evil life shall back to Satan where it came from. And let the word of God revive our dying land. For Jesus Christ is coming back again in all his glory. And every eye shall see him on that day. That's why a new anointing of God's power is coming on us. To boldly tell the world you must be saved. Because astrology won't save you. Your horoscope won't save you. The Bible says these things are all parts. If you're born again, you don't need to look to the stars for your answer. Because you can look to the very one who made those stars. History tells us time and time again, to live like there's no God makes you a fool. If you want to see kids live right, stop handing out condoms. And start handing out the word of God in school.
The only hope for America.
The only hope for our country is Him. If we repent of our way, stand firm and say, we need God in America again. I know the only hope for America is Him. The only hope.
Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, we have with us this evening a Mr. Phelps, and we're going to be talking about, of all things, banking. Now, why would anybody want to think about banking? Well, today America faces probably the greatest economic crisis of all time. And, of course, not simply because of the problems we face, but because we have been exporting problems throughout the world. As our central bank works in concert with other central banks throughout the world, all privately owned by a group of very wealthy men who have a different vision of what the world should be. They don't believe in individual freedom. They believe in a one-world government under the control of a ruling elite, and, of course, going along with that, a new world religion. But the whole system that they've created through the past 90 years is beginning to implode, and we are very, very soon going to see the end result of what happens to a nation that turns its back on solid currency that gives to a private group of men who are motivated not by idealism but by selfishness the ability to produce its money. Mr. Phelps, are you there?
Yes, I am, Stan, right here.
Now, how long have you been involved in studying money?
About 60 years.
And you, of course, your dad before you was a doctor, and he also was very interested in economics, wasn't he?
Yes, because he had occasion to get involved with the higher echelons of government as the first director of the Division of Preventive Medicine of the Navy's BuMed, and he was an epidemiologist, and he was the closest Navy doctor to Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt's home when Franklin was the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, so he got called over there occasionally at night to take care of Franklin's speechwriter and political strategist named Lewis Howe, who had asthma and a few other things. And so my parents got to know Franklin and Eleanor quite closely, and also my uncle was a classmate of Roosevelt's at Harvard.
All right, well, now, of course, why, just knowing Roosevelt, why did that interest your father in the monetary system?
Because in his discussions, you know, while waiting for things at their home, talking with Franklin, he realized that the bankers had a heavy influence on Franklin Roosevelt, even at that early point in Roosevelt's career. And Louis Howe was their front man, their journalist, who was giving Roosevelt all of his strategy and so forth. And the bankers wanted to get Roosevelt under their control intellectually. And my father realized that this was not a good way for the country to go, so he began to study money himself to see what makes money tick and what money really is.
All right, fine. Well, now, how did Roosevelt feel about that time about it? Was he willing to go along with him, or was he concerned about the money power and its influence over him and over the government as a whole?
I, of course, was not born yet, so I can't tell you from having been there, but what I gathered was that Roosevelt was not intellectually up on the details of monetary systems, and he simply took their advice because of the way it was presented to him, and when he became president, he did just about what they told him to do.
Well, it's really very interesting. When I went through Colonel House's papers back at Yale University in 1980, and I came across a letter that President Roosevelt had written to Colonel House, and this was in November 21st, 1933, as I remember. And in that letter, he said, talking about having had lunch with Jack Morgan, that was J.P. Morgan's son, mm-hmm. and they had a nice conversation. And then he said to Colonel House, he wrote to Colonel House, as you and I both know, why the financial powers have run and owned the government of the United States going back to the time of Andrew Jackson. And
yes.
I'm not entirely excluding the regime of WW,
that's
meaning,
right.
Of course, Woodrow Wilson, where Colonel House had played an instrumental part. Of course, I don't think that Roosevelt really realized that Colonel House was their emissary, that he was there to manipulate the President of the United States at that time, just as he had manipulated and controlled Woodrow Wilson. In fact, Colonel House had almost a mystical ability to control other men.
That's right. And after Colonel House died, he was succeeded by a succession of people like Bernard Baruch and Harry Hopkins and Arthur Schlesinger and various other people. Always the president has had someone at his elbow telling him what to do, particularly about the monetary system.
All right, fine. So let's get into the background of the monetary system, because I think most people have no idea how it works. I mean, they have money at the greenbacks. They always look the same. They're not going to much longer. They're going to come out with a new colored money here in the very near future. But
no.
I think the average individual, you know, go to the bank, you borrow money, you pay interest on the money, you own your home. At least you think you own your home.
Mm-hmm.
You buy things at the Kmart or Walmart. And they think that they really understand money. But they really don't, do they?
No, and I find that if we're going to have a discussion about a subject, it's best that both parties to the discussion, or all parties to the discussion, which includes your listeners, of course, understand what I mean by certain words that I will use. So I'd like to just give you a quick definition of a few terms here.
You go right ahead.
Mind. First, I want to talk about the three powers of sovereignty. In other words, what are the three powers that enable any particular person to rule a nation? And those three powers of sovereignty I call governance, force, and money. It's sort of like a three-legged milk stool in the dairy farm. You know, a three-legged milk stool won't tip over very easily, and it won't rock, because 3 points determine a plane, so no matter how you set it down, it's pretty firm. So these three powers of sovereignty, governance, force, and money, are what enable a person to rule. Governments down through history have been very reluctant to give up their governance power, that is, the power to pass laws and try violators and adjudicate all matters that arise among the citizens. They've been reluctant to give that up. They're very much reluctant to give up their force power, the ability to police and to have military forces to protect the nation and so forth, and in many cases to establish their control over the citizenry. But they have often given up the money power, the third power, because of really ignorance about how monetary systems work. And if a person can get the money power away from the sovereign, he can pay for all the governance and force he wants by means of controlling the legislators and the military and so forth with his money. And one of the Rothschilds made a very interesting statement, and I just saw it the other day again. He said, let me issue and control a nation's money, and I care not who makes its laws.
Well, whether it's the Rothschilds or whoever it is who's controlling the money, certainly if you control the money power, why, you control the nation. And Professor Quigley makes that very, very clear in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. Are you acquainted with Professor Quigley's work?
I have not read all of his work. Well, he wrote very extensively.
He really did. But on page 324 of his classic book, he simply points out that the central banks, all of which are privately owned, really control their respective governments. They work together secretly. Their goal is to create a feudalistic system under their control. A feudalistic system is one with lords and serfs, and that's what it's really all about. Our banks are private. Our central banks are privately owned. They control the money power of every nation in the world. They work together through the Bank of International Settlement. I believe it's in Basel in Switzerland. And they really control the governments. They control the people. They control the world.
Right, they do. And I'd like to talk a bit about how it's possible for them to do this.
All right, fine.
First of all, I want to define what I mean by the word money or credit. Money and credit, in my vocabulary, are interchangeable. And both of them, or money, let's say money, is a promise. That's all money is. It's a promise that postpones or defers immediate compensation and is universally acceptable for the payment of obligations and taxes. That is what I mean by money. Money is a promise, an unfulfilled promise. And I like to define work. Work is any activity that changes the form, condition, and location of natural resources to produce something or some service of value. The activity is the application, of course, of human energy multiplied by tools. We talk about goods and services. All things of value produced by work, which I've just defined. We talk about the GNP, the gross national product. That is the value of the total production of a nation expressed in monetary units, such as dollars or pounds or francs or pesos or rubles or yen. Now, what is a transaction? There are transactions going on every minute of every day all over the country, in our case. A transaction is an exchange between two or more persons in which each party receives something it desires and in return gives up something desired by the other party. The things that are given and received are called consideration, and transactions occur as a result of a written or an assumed contract or agreement. Now, the three parts of a contract or agreement, as we learn in Economics 1, are offer, acceptance, and consideration. We told them about what consideration is. It's these things that are given up and received in return. What is barter, then? A barter is an exchange in which all the parties receive immediate consideration. It is a closed exchange. It's a transaction that ends immediately. It's almost never used in modern societies with large urban populations, but it's frequently used by school children who trade toys and other articles of common interest. Now, an open transaction, on the other hand, opposite from a barter, an open transaction is a transaction in which the consideration received by one or more parties is deferred in the form of money and or other instruments of credit. So we know that if it is an open transaction, it goes on and on and on until it is finally closed out by receiving goods and services of value. A money creator is any person or group that creates instruments of credit, such as money, bills, letters of credit, or accounting entries, repeat, or accounting entries, and makes them available for circulation. That's the money creator. There are two ways to make new money or credit available for circulation. I have not been able to find any other ways. One, the money creator can spend it or give it away. Two, the money creator can lend it and get it back. Now, who can do this? Well, method one, spend it or give it away, can be done by the sovereign or bankers and counterfeiters. Number two, lend it and get it back, can be done by the sovereign or by bankers. We'll talk about that as we describe this monetary system. I have definitions of fiat money. That is instruments of credit issued by the decree or fiat of the sovereign. We have counter fiat money. Not counterfeit, but counter hyphen fiat money. That's instruments of credit issued by bankers as opposed to the de jure sovereign, the real sovereign. And counterfeit money is bogus bills printed and issued by private persons in violation of the law. Now, if we can keep those definitions in mind as we discuss the monetary system, I think it'll be clear to everybody what we're talking about. I want to let you say something once in a while, Dr. Stan, because you may be brimming with questions at this point.
No. I'm very interested in what you have to say. Basically, there are two ways to produce money. The sovereign produces it, or the banks produce it.
That's right.
And so it's really that simple. But how can the banks produce money? And I think that's people don't understand.
That's the fascinating part of what we call bank magic.
But the other thing is, of course, that here in the United States, the sovereign or the government has simply given the private bank the ability to create money. And, of course, although the Treasury, U.S. Treasury Department, prints the money, they then give that money to the Federal Reserve System, to the privately owned central bank. That's pretty good. I wish somebody would give me.
That was going to be my starting point.
All right,
that is
fine. Well, I'll let you pick it up there.
The process starts.
And I think that it's important that people understand that we have a privately owned central bank. It is formed not to help the people, not to maintain a stable economy. It is formed to enrich the bankers, to give them the power for their political and religious purposes, and, of course, to enslave the people into a system. And the system always ends up cheating the public and enriching the bankers. So why don't you take off from there?
All right. That has happened over and over again in world history. For example, quoted from Dr. Jaikarkin in his book, The Debt Virus, he says, when ancient Egypt fell, only 4% of the population held all of the wealth. When the Babylonian civilization collapsed, Only 3% of the population owned all the wealth. When ancient Persia was destroyed, 2% of the people owned all the wealth. When ancient Greece sank into ruin, only 0.5% of the people held all the wealth. And when the Roman Empire collapsed into ruin, only about 2,000 people owned all the wealth in the known civilized world. And this debacle ushered in the period of history known as the Dark Ages. Now, why did this happen over and over? Because of something that was discovered early on by the goldsmiths who became bankers because they owned banks of vaults that people could put their gold in. They found that they would give a warehouse receipt to a person who deposited one piece of gold with them, that later on, only about 1 out of 5 people came back to the banker to cash their bank receipt, their warehouse receipt, and get their gold back. The people preferred simply to trade their warehouse receipt as a promise to someone else. And if the goldsmith was a respected person, his warehouse note was accepted as value. So the goldsmiths in their guild got together and said, you know, only 1 out of 5 people come back, so we really can issue enough warehouse receipts to cover 5 times that much gold. We only need a fractional reserve of 20% of gold to give back to the people.
Now, of course, this can be dated back to the time of the Knights Templar back in the 1200s. They were the first international bankers. They were the first one to issue paper money, checks, really. This has been going on for a long, long, long time.
Right.
Actually, of course, following the fall of Rome, the people were reduced to a barter system in the West. People have forgotten there were two parts of the Roman Empire then. One was in the East, governed from Constantinople,
Where
the golden Byzant, was used as a means of exchange. They had a stable society that lasted for 1,000 years, fell in 1282, and of course, that was known as the Byzantine Empire. Why? Because the currency was the Byzant. The average individual doesn't know that. In the West, they continued to debauch the currency, and Rome fell in 476. And then they went into a barter system that persisted for, centuries until eventually gold and silver coins were reintroduced. And then we find the Templars coming along as the first international bankers. There were Italian bankers, there were Jewish bankers at the time, but they only had lent locally. The Templars were international bankers. And, of course, they were the dominant force in Europe during the 1200s. But why don't you pick up the story from there? And then, of course, we have this, the beginning of banking about that time.
Yeah, let's go to the year 1066 when William of Normandy brought his Norman legions across the English Channel and defeated King Harold, the Saxon king of England, in 1066. William became the crown ruler of England, and then one of his sons became Henry I. Now, Henry I apparently understood monetary systems because he realized that the crown had to create the sovereign money. And he used what were called tally sticks, which he simply issued to support legislation that he had Parliament pass to do certain things, raise an army, build a ship, whatever the government needed to spend money for. He spent tally sticks, and he insisted that they have to bring those tally sticks back to the treasury to pay their taxes. The nobles who were landowners had to pay their taxes with tally sticks, and Shakespeare, writing in his sonnets, said, I need not tallies, thy dear love to count, or whatever. Well, those tally sticks were used as the basis for English monetary system for over 700 years. It was a debt-free money system. Our modern money system today is not debt-free. It is a system in which all of our money is created by monetization of debt. And here's how the trail begins. When the Federal Reserve decides that the economy needs more money circulating to speed things up a bit, it will lend money to the United States Treasury by the act of buying a United States Treasury bond. Most of that buying direct from the open bond market is done by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York following instructions of the Open Market Committee. Now, let's imagine the bond broker at the open market receiving an order from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York for $100 million worth of $100 million worth of United States Treasury bonds. The bond broker, representing a bunch of bond owners, will get them together and deliver them to the Fed and accept the Fed's check for $100 million. This happens quite frequently, almost as often as every morning. Why will a bond broker accept the Fed bank's check for $100 million? Because, as you said earlier, he knows the Federal Reserve Bank of New York could go to the Treasury Department and request them to deliver $100 million worth of $100 bills and could cash his check if he, the bond broker, wanted to cash his check. And that gives that check the validity of being a real promise. Of course, he doesn't ask for the currency. He simply deposits that check in his commercial bank and then writes checks on that account of his in the commercial bank to pay off all the owners of the bond, minus his commission, of course. So here we have this commercial bank wherein the bond broker maintains his commercial account, and it receives this check for $100 million, and it says, well, we better send this on and process and clear this check to get a credit for $100 million here. So they send it back to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, who stamp it and put it in the drawer. The loop is completed, and $100 million of new money has now gone into the banking system, which will gradually filter out through many different transactions. And it's what's called high-powered money. It will form part of the bank reserves of all those commercial banks that handle part of it.
And so what you're really basically seeing is money created out of nothing. And the more money you have in circulation, the more apparent prosperity you have. And, of course, it works, and it works very, very well for a time.
Yeah.
But since there's nothing behind the money, then, of course, very soon you have to begin putting more money into the system, of course, to maintain the same level of prosperity.
Yeah.
And, of course, this is and the only reason that we haven't had runaway inflation here in the United States is simply because we've been transferring our products, our money to other countries. The dollar is used as a reserve currency throughout the world.
That's right.
Because one time it was as good as gold. And then, of course, in August 15th, 1971, when President Nixon closed the gold window, why the dollar was still the strongest currency in the world, and everybody needed the industrial products we had. And so they were willing, of course, to continue taking our money. And then, of course, they could come back and they could buy the factories or the goods or the products we had here in the United States.
Yeah.
At that time, America was the strongest credit a nation in the world. In other words, we were lending money all throughout the world. Today, we are the greatest debtor nation in the world.
That's right.
In those days, we had a solid industrial base in August of 1971, and we were the greatest producer of goods in the world. Today,
sure,
we are
yes.
the greatest consumer of goods in the world, and we no longer have a valid industrial base. In fact, of our $10.5 or $10.6 trillion gross domestic product,
yeah.
probably a little more than a quarter of that is an industrial base, because our leaders have intentionally transferred our industrial base overseas to build up the economies of other nations and eventually to impoverish ours. But the average American really doesn't understand what's going on.
That's right.
And so he simply goes along blithely thinking things are going to get better without realizing there's an organized effort to impoverish him.
Now, we've just talked about the tip of the iceberg with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York buying $100 million worth of bonds, because that money that filters out into the commercial banking system now allows these banks to create more money in the way that commercial banks create money, and that's by monetization of private debt.
Why don't you explain that? Because I think that this is the key to understanding everything that's going on
today. It is, and I don't want to make it seem too complicated, because it's very simple. Once you understand it, you wonder why everybody else doesn't.
They win, we lose. That's what it's all about. Go ahead.
Here's what happens. Let's say you wanted to buy a new house for $120,000. These days, it isn't much of a house anymore. But let's say you wanted to spend $120,000 for a house. And you go to your banker, and you tell him that you'd like to finance the house, that you can put $20,000 down, and you'd like to finance the $100,000. So he says, fine, just sign this mortgage, or in the case of the western part of the United States, this note secured by a first trust deed to us for $100,000, and we will credit your checking account with $100,000, or we'll write a check to your escrow officer, whatever. Now, see what they did with their accounting system. They took the $100,000 first trust deed that you signed and put that in their vault and said, that's worth $100,000 to us, so we'll enter $100,000 in our assets ledger. And then they set up a $100,000 checking account for you, say, and they'll say, now that's a liability of ours. We hold ourselves ready to pay checks written on this account up to $100,000. So they enter a credit entry in their liability ledger for $100,000. And their books are still in balance. The asset entry equaled the liability.
The only trouble is they've created $100,000 out of absolutely nothing.
That's right.
And, of course, you're going to have to pay interest on the $100,000
they
created.
The process by which they created this magic, they have a formal name for. It's called fractional reserve deposit expansion.
We're going to be back here in just a moment with Mr. Phelps, and we'll invite your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course we hope that many of you out there in the listening audience will certainly want to learn more about what we're talking about. If my latest newsletter, my December newsletter, is going to go into great detail on the fractional reserve banking system. Our last month's newsletter, the November newsletter, went into the background of fiat money systems, and the December newsletter will explain to you how this whole system is working, where America is going, and what you must do to survive. Because believe me, ladies and gentlemen, if you don't make the steps right now to protect yourself, you stand to lose literally everything you have. In England, within the last couple of days, many of the people have been told they're going to have to wait until they're 70 to get retire, that they face being impoverished in their retirement years, because the government just doesn't have the money to pay out. That's not a very popular message, but the truth of the matter is, at least their politicians are being honest with them. You're not hearing about that here in America, because we're in the same bit, but our politicians aren't telling us the truth, that there is no money to pay off the $20 billion we promised to pay our citizens and haven't bothered to budget for. And with another $30 billion in debt, we can't very well have any hope that there'll be any money to redeem all those notes we put into the Social Security and Medicare funds as we've blithely spent the retirement of our children and our grandchildren living the good life today. Well, if you'd like, of course, to get my December newsletter, I won't be available for a few days, but you're welcome to give us a call at 1-800-544-8927, and we'll be... That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. We'll be glad to send you a free copy of our newsletter. But more than that, of course, we hope many of you will want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters, which is how we're able to do what we do 5 hours a day on 5 hours of radio, 5 hours of internet, 3 hours of satellite, 2 hours of shortwave, as we reach out across America and around the world with the news behind the news, the story behind the story. And so if you'd like to become part of our team, part of the Radio Liberty family, we'd love to hear from you. Again, the number 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. You can, of course, help us by going to our website, pulling down our newsletters. If you don't subscribe to the newsletter, and copy that and get those newsletters out across America. By recording the programs that are available there on the archive programs, and this program will be archived, and you can listen to it again several times, because it's important you hear what our guest is saying and understand the basis of our monetary system. And so you can, that's www.radioliberty.com. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will give serious consideration to telling others, your friends, about our programs, get them going to our website. It's up to you to reach as many people as you can in the time that we have, because the American people don't understand what's going on, or indeed the spiritual forces working behind the scenes, then the freedom we have enjoyed during our lifetimes may soon become simply a remembrance of things past. Well, we'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest this evening, Mr. Joseph Phelps. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and I want Mr. Phelps to go on. I'm not going to invite calls for the time being until we've really developed this whole idea, because even an hour is a very, very short period of time to understand what we're saying. So Mr. Phelps has been talking about the fractional reserve banking system, by which the banks only have to, if you're a small bank, you only have to keep 3% of your loans as a reserve, or you only keep a fraction of the money you've loaned out on reserve. And so you can actually loan out, well, under that system, 97% of the money that you have can be lent out and 3% kept on reserve. And, of course, if you're a large bank, apparently you have to keep about 10% reserves, which means that for every $100 you have, you can lend out $90. And then, of course, that multiplies and multiplies and multiplies, which is why, based upon the currency in circulation of some $660 billion, we have over $8.3 trillion of monetary increments, and then, of course, built upon that is another $30 trillion. That's $8.3 trillion of monetary increments and checking accounts, savings account, all of these things. And then, of course, the total U.S. debt is $30.9 trillion, increased $5 trillion in the last 3 years. $5 trillion to monetary increments to Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae and the Federal Reserve System, flooding the economy, trying to keep the whole thing from imploding, and it hasn't worked.
Let me try to suggest the reasons why it's impossible to keep a debt money system from exploding or imploding.
Please do.
The commercial banks, under the fractional reserve deposit expansion banking system, will end up creating $9 for every dollar the Fed creates, $9 more. So, and they multiply by 10 to 1 because the average fractional reserve is 10%. Now, observe that when you borrowed that $100,000 for your house, in our little story, they credited your account with $100,000, period. They did not put some more money on there that you could use to pay interest back to them. Nobody is creating money for you to pay interest. You have to find ways to raise the interest that you owe them from your own earnings. In other words, you have to get someone else's money to pay the interest on your loan, because your loan payments, you'll see, are interest part is much larger than the principal reduction part. So what this means is that for the nation as a whole, for the economy as a whole, for all the giant corporations that have borrowed large sums of money, when it comes time to close the books at the end of the year and find some money to pay the interest to the banks, it's not there. So they have to refinance. The whole economy has to refinance every year in order to borrow more money to pay the interest that they owe on the previous year. And that means that you're thrown into a compound interest situation. And I remember a story told about Albert Einstein, when he was at my alma mater, Caltech, as a visiting lecturer, they said, someone asked him, Dr. Einstein, what would you consider as the greatest power in the world? Is it your theory of relativity? And he said, no, the greatest power in the world is compound interest. And what that means is that the amount that's owed is much greater than the original sum of money that it was created, that the loan created. And it goes up and up and up every year by the compound interest formula, which mathematicians will tell you is 1 plus R to the nth power. That's the compound interest formula. It makes a curve that curves right on up and starts going up vertically after a while. That's the implosion, because when it gets too high, the whole system is unstable and it crashes again.
And, of course, that's where we're facing our national debt. I mean, they're lying to us about the national debt. They're telling us, oh, our deficit last year was $158 billion. $158 billion.
Yeah.
But, of course, the truth of the matter is it was over $400 billion. Now, how could they make that much of a mistake? Well, they just forgot to mention that they'd stolen $250 billion from Medicare and Social Security and put in worthless government loans backed by the full integrity of a government that is totally bankrupt, both morally and financially, has no money other than what it can take from the people. If it takes 2 months' money, the people just quit paying their taxes and revolt.
Right. A debt money system is not an honest monetary system.
Of course it isn't. So actually, our national debt went up last year, $400 billion. But they kept telling the American people, we have all these articles, our debt was only $158 billion, but it really was over $400 billion. And this year it's already over $500 billion and reaching for heaven only knows how much. But we have all the figures and we'll make them available to any of our people who really want to research this. So pick up the story from there, Mr.
Well, let's take... Let's take, on the other hand, a debt-free monetary system. That's a system in which the sovereign, and only the true sovereign, can create money. And no one else is allowed to create money. The sovereign can create money and spend it into circulation in great quantity, and the sovereign can create money and lend it to the banking system to lend on to people that need house mortgages and companies that need to finance their operations. But when the sovereign, the true sovereign, is the source of the money, we don't have this compound interest of having to pay out more and more money in interest to the people who created the money. The end result of a debt-free monetary system is a situation cannot arise in which the sovereign doesn't have enough money to pay the sovereign's bills and has to borrow it. The government of the United States should never borrow money except money that is already in circulation that people have saved as their personal savings. That the government can borrow. No problem there. That money is already in circulation. But the government should never borrow money from banks, because the government can print its money as it needs it, or issue credit as it needs it. It's ridiculous to think of a sovereign government not having enough money.
Well, but then what happens if it just says, well, look, let's double the money supply so we'll have more money to spend this year, and then, we'll have to double it next year again because, we had a great time last year, but the economy is beginning to slow down. Where, then, do you have to have a responsible government, and where do you ever find a responsible government? What keeps them from just multiplying the money or the number of tally sticks or the number amount of paper money as much as they want to in the name of, well, let's live it up today.
All right. Here's
eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die.
The law is what keeps them. The law is written to govern the value of the dollar. And the law says that the government's flow of funds into circulation through government expenditures must equal the flow of funds into the U.S. Treasury by taxation and interest. Not just taxation, but taxation and interest.
Well, you know, our Constitution had a very specific stipulation as to where money was to come from. Do you believe in the constitutional requirements for money, or would you disagree with that?
I absolutely believe in that. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5. The Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof and of foreign coin. And I'm not reading that out of a book. I know that phrase.
But it was also to be tied to gold, and specifically a specific amount of gold would be a dollar. And we had a system where there was no inflation for, what, 100 and some odd years?
I don't care about gold being the basis for money. Our money is backed by the production of the American economy, the results of the work of the people of the United States, because every dollar you have in your pocket is a claim for $1 worth of that production.
Well, that, of course, is an entirely different concept than the concept of our Constitution.
No, I'm
sorry.
It
was specifically said that it would be based upon gold. Isn't that what it says in the Constitution?
No.
What does it say in the Constitution?
It says the Congress shall have the power to coin money and regulate the value thereof and of foreign coin. And they don't capitalize the first word coin because it's a verb and it means create. And then they capitalize the last use of the word coin because they were specifically referring to the coin currency of foreign nations at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But I see nowhere where it mandates that Congress use gold as a basis for the dollar.
No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation, grant letters, or marquee and reprisal, coin money, emit bills, make anything but gold and silver coin, a tender in payment of debts.
No state.
Right.
They're telling the states that they can't issue money.
Except if they are gold and silver coin.
Fine, because gold and silver coin have a value and they're not creating new money.
Right, absolutely. And so,
but that doesn't mandate our Congress to use gold as a basis for the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that they don't want anybody except the Congress to have the right to issue bills of credit, which are United States notes, the fact that they don't want any state or any person to do that. Only Congress has the power to create money in the sense of my definition of money creator.
Mm-hmm.
And let's get back to the money creator now. How many ways does he have to put that money into circulation, and what becomes of the money? Well, first we know, we talked about, he has the right to lend it into circulation, and he has the right to spend it into circulation. Now, we know from our studies of monetary technology that it is not good if the amount of debt-free money is less than half of the M1 money supply. We need at least half of the money supply to be debt-free, have been spent by the government into circulation, and the government received consideration for it in the body of goods and services purchased. That money has no debt attached to it and will remain in circulation indefinitely. We need the half of our M1 supply be that kind of money. The other part is money that is based upon what the government has lent to the banking system at a certain treasury lending rate. This is a treasury credit money system. In other words, it reverses the relationship between the treasury of the United States and the banking system. From being a borrower, it changes the treasury into a lender. Now, how could that treasury then ever run a deficit? It cannot. But it can't go hog wild either, because it can only create money in accordance with a memorandum from Congress that says, we just appropriated so many million dollars for a project here, and you are to create that amount of credit and deposit that in our account in the Federal Reserve or commercial bank.
All right, fine. We've got Jeannie calling in here. Hi, Jeannie. Do you have a question or comment?
Well, maybe this will clarify something. We have the Black Law Dictionary, the fourth edition, written in 1951. And if you look up the definition of the dollar, mm-hmm. it says specifically the unit employed in the United States in calculating money values. Mm-hmm. It is coined both in gold and silver and is of the value of 100 cents. Mm-hmm. And that is also in the United States Code 31, Section 314.
Okay, that's all true.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anything else, Jeannie?
No, that's it.
Thank you. Okay, Bye. Go ahead. All right, how are you going to reply to Jeannie?
Jeannie True?
Yes, uh-huh. She's gone. She disappeared.
These things are correct. They are in Black's Law Dictionary and so forth. But the price of gold during the last 100 years has fluctuated wildly.
Well, of course, it's fluctuated because it's being controlled by the international bankers.
That's right.
Who do not want a gold-backed system, because if we don't have a gold-backed system, then we have no alternative but to use their paper money.
Well,
and so there's no other medium of
that
exchange.
That I don't agree with. I don't agree that the bankers do not want a gold-backed system.
Well, then why do they? If they don't want a gold-backed system, why have they bought up all the gold and held it and then consistently drive down the price?
Because they want to control gold just as much as the diamond syndicate wants to control diamond prices.
But, of course, by so doing, they force us to use their paper money. In other words, we have to use their paper money. If we don't have gold as a currency, then, of course, the only medium is their paper.
I will make this statement, Dr. Monteith. Gold is not money. Gold is a commodity. You could save galvanized roofing nails as a commodity if you wanted to have a value thing, but you'd have to have a huge warehouse, whereas you don't have to save very much gold because it's of a higher value. But all the talk about gold is mainly designed to confuse the public.
And
the truth of the matter is that the working production of the American people is what backs up our money, and we should be using United States notes and not allowing the banks to print Federal Reserve notes. The banks only use the Treasury Department as a contract printing company to print the stuff for them. But when it's printed, it belongs to the banks. And until we reverse the monetary situation and have the Congress of the United States and only the Congress of the United States given the power to create money, as I have defined it, then we will always have a system that's out of control and unstable and will crash every so often. And it gets, at that point of crash, not even the bankers can control it at that point. So it's automatic. It crashes. And the bankers convert their loans into real property. By foreclosure.
Well, yeah, they certainly do. I noticed in your writings you have had frequent references to the quotation by Thomas Jefferson that opposing the banking system and saying it would lead to impoverishing our people.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, if you, and I have the complete quotation from the Master Thoughts of Thomas Jefferson, where he said, basically, I'm against all banknotes. I mean, I am against everything but coin based upon gold and silver. Now, I know you don't agree with that.
Don't agree with Jefferson on that. I agree with Benjamin Franklin, who said we have prosperity in the colonies because we issue our own script in sufficient quantity to take care of the people's needs for exchange and transactions.
All right, fine. Well, we got Ron calling from Washington, D.C. Of course, they had their script here. It was called the Continental Paper. And it, you remember what happened to the Continental. All right, now let's go to Ron calling from Washington. Ron, is that you?
Yes, sir. Another medium of exchange. A friend of mine worked at the Department of Agriculture. There's these items called food stamps that the government gives out that are also passed into circulation. And some people sell them for 50 cents on the dollar so they can buy things that they're really prohibited from buying with food stamps.
But, of course, they're not supposed to, but, of course, everybody will find a means of doing things dishonest.
So that was almost like there's another currency that's
right,
being introduced.
Right, you're absolutely right. It's illegal, it's dishonest, but then, of course, whenever you invite people to be dishonest, it's amazing how often they'll take you up on it. And do you want to comment at all on what Ron said there?
Do I want to comment on it?
Right.
If the IRS would accept bus tokens, people would be able to spend bus tokens for food.
Okay, but just what the way they have the system working, Ron, is that you have to have the legal tender of the government to pay your taxes.
That's
and
correct.
You have to have the legal tender to pay your property taxes. You have to have the legal tender to pay your IRS taxes. So since the banks work right along with the IRS, they force us to use their money to pay our taxes, and therefore it becomes the coin of the realm, as it were. Oh, anything else, Ron?
That's true of any sovereign.
Right. Oh, I guess we lost Ron. You're gone.
That's what Henry I knew that he had to do. He had to insist that his tally sticks be used, and only his tally sticks, to pay the nobleman's land taxes.
All right, now, but how do we get a responsible government? That's the next step.
By writing the money law, the monetary law.
But our government today doesn't obey the law.
It's already written, but I should say by having that law passed.
But the thing is that our officials don't follow the law. Right now, today, we see, new laws being put in that restrict the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution and the Second Amendment to the Constitution. And, so many of the things that our government is doing are simply in violation of the law because our leaders don't believe in the Constitution.
Well,
I mean, that's the real big problem, and the average American doesn't even know what the Constitution says.
That's right. So the solution to our problem is first to inform the people and show the people that it's the blood of their life they're dealing with, and they must learn about the monetary system and enforce it by getting their representatives in Congress to enact suitable legislation.
Well, I agree with that totally, and I think...
But I want to assure everyone that a good debt-free money system will not run out of control, run amok through irresponsibility if the law is properly written. We want the money to be regulated by law and not by the decisions of a small group of very powerful people who are not in government.
But that's always the way that it is. That's the way it's run right today. In
fact,
most of the average American doesn't even understand that our Federal Reserve System is not a government agency. And, of course, the head of the Federal Reserve has always comes from the Council on Foreign Relations. I think since 1913, there's only been two chairmen of the Fed who didn't come from this elite club there.
And the governor of the Bank of England always comes from Brown Brothers Sharp.
Right. And, of course, and the central banks all work together. That is the amazing thing.
It's kind of interesting that the great-grandfather of President George W. Bush, whose name was George Herbert Walker, was executive vice president of Brown Brothers Harriman, the New York branch of Brown Brothers Sharp.
No, I didn't know that. I knew his grandfather was Prescott Bush. Prescott was certainly with Brown Brothers Harriman. I didn't know the great-grandfather was.
Well, it's grandfather of George Herbert Walker Bush.
Our grandfather, Herbert Walker Bush, okay.
George Herbert Walker Bush.
Right, that would have been Prescott's father.
That's right, his maternal grandfather was George Herbert Walker.
Okay, I see, George Herbert Walker.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fine, I didn't know that. Well, yeah. But what people don't understand is that these banking families, they go from generation to generation to generation. And there's always a sort of a mysterious force behind them, whether it's the Roosevelts or the Bushes or the Rockefellers.
And the name of that force is Fractional Reserve Deposit Expansion.
All right, fine. Well, we've just got a couple of minutes more here. What are the parting thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners this evening?
Do I have any other thoughts I'd like to leave?
Yes, we've got about a minute and a half to go.
I would say... Social Security wouldn't be a problem with a treasury credit money system. The government could manufacture money to pay for the Social Security, and if they wanted to give the economy a shot in the arm, could very, very easily make a special payment on one check and put more money into circulation immediately that way.
Now George Bush did that recently. He gave everybody $300.
But they have to borrow the money now to do it.
Right.
But we have to have a treasury credit money system. The first thing we have to do is write legislation that reverses the debtor-creditor relationship between the treasury and the banking system. We have to reverse that relationship.
All right, fine. Well, do you have a telephone number or a website you'd like to get out?
Yeah, my website is algaoaktree.com. That's algaoaktree.com. And my email address is oaktree, O-H-A-T-R-E-E, at P-E.net.
Okay. That's oaktree at P-E.net.
Oaktree at P-E.net. That's my email. My website is
algaoaktree.com. Okay, that's algaoaktree.com.
And
look, thank
they
you,
can sir. Click on a money menu that will give them an introduction to all of these subjects. And I'm going to put my latest pamphlet that you have a copy of, I'm going to put that on my web so they can download that and print it out.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us. It's been fascinating. We'll have to get you back again.
Yeah. Good night. If more questions arise, I'd be happy to come on and answer
okay.
them.
Good night. We're going to have to let you go. And this is Dr. Stan saying, I ask you to pray for America and pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing in the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And, of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line right now from World Affairs Brief, Joel Skousen. Hi, Joel. How are you doing?
Great, Stan. It's been a great holiday season and a wonderful time. So nice to be with you tonight.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Anyway, of course, you're constantly coming up with a new analysis of what's happening in the news on a regular basis. Tell me, what are the things that you're concerned about tonight?
Well, your producer said you had a very interesting and perhaps controversial last hour talking about some things with the banking system. I thought I might contribute something about the economy. I've had quite a few consultations with people asking about what's headed up with the economy and what the Fed is going to do. And it's a very interesting situation because, in reality, Federal Reserve has been playing the interest rates for all they're worth, cutting the discount rate 11 times in the past 11 months, and frankly, they're just about out of ammunition in that regard. What's very interesting is that for years, the Federal Reserve has been able to increase the money supply at about a 20% clip per year, and it hasn't shown up as 20% inflation in the United States as it would in any normal country who is inflating their money supply at that rate, because the overseas economy, the international economy, has been increasingly becoming a dollar-denominated economy and has absorbed those dollars, thus sparing the United States from the ravages of inflation, which would normally accompany this kind of a fiat money policy. But that's about to end, especially as the dollar is showing weakness around the world. That means that with the slowdown in the economy, there isn't as much demand for dollars for international trade. Other nations have not reached bottom. Well, Japan has reached bottom on interest rates. They're running about a zero interest rate, and we're running about 1.75%. So the Fed maybe has two or three interest rate moves before they get to the essential zero mark. And what that really means, Stan, is that about the only large piece of ammunition the Fed has got left is actually to really inflate the currency in a way and to bail out this economy with lots more paper money at a greater rate even than the 20% rate they've been inflating at. And so it looks like in the future we may have a major inflationary scenario here in the United States.
Well, you know, it's really very interesting. They have actually increased the liquidity, not the currency in circulation or the M1, M2, and M3, but the national debt has increased in the last 3 years because of money infused into the system through Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and of course, the Fed. $5 trillion. $5 trillion. I mean, it took us almost 200 years to go from, to incur $1 trillion in national debt, and it was even with Jimmy Carter and all the others we had there. But, in the last 3 years, increased $5 trillion. And I sure assume that's all the money that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have been pouring out, offering cheap loans and things of that sort. So you try to get that money to stimulate the economy, and it
hasn't
worked.
That's only the increase,
right,
Stan. The total outstanding that Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have put out is $300 trillion. That's the bubble. And the reason why it has to, why they've increased the lending at such a clip is that in order to keep this bubble inflated, you have to increase the amount of yearly input in order to keep this thing moving.
Or otherwise, why the price of houses begins to come down, and suddenly you've got all these houses they've lent money on, and they aren't worth the amount of money that they've lent, and then you get into the same situation they have in Japan, where property values drop 80%.
That's right. One of the things that's interesting about the housing market is that they have run nearly this unlimited amount of money available for approximately the past 10, 12 years now. You know, it used to be in the economy that you'd have to wait until savings increased or people redeemed or paid off their loans before banks had more loan money to lend out. I can remember when I was just starting a family, when I'd go to the bank for a loan for a house, they'd say, well, gee, we just don't have, money's real tight now, we just don't have it. You never hear that anymore from a banker or a savings and loan that money's tight. They can get any amount of money that they want as long as they go to the discount window of the Fed and just say, give us the money and we'll tack 2% on it. And we remarket the loan to these large mortgage investment firms. So with this kind of wide open debt mentality, they've literally loaned to almost everybody who can barely afford something, and they're running out of eligible buyers.
And, of course, it's sort of like with the car market. I mean, they're offering people, Mitsubishi is offering you a brand-new car, nothing down, no interest and no payments till the year 2004. The only trouble is, what's going to happen in 2004? How are people going to be buying cars? I'm amazed at the number of new cars on the road. In fact, it's the car market that has been so deeply discounted with all sorts of benefits and gimmicks that is really keeping our production up in this country. Otherwise, our production rate would actually be falling.
Yes, that and the housing market, Stan.
Right.
Those are the two major consumer items where the Fed has a direct input method by allowing free money to finance these things. It's a high-demand item. Everybody wants housing and transportation. But there are two or three factors that are starting to really negatively affect the housing market. One is that they've pretty well farmed the bushes for anybody who can possibly get a loan to get into a house, and they're running out of balloon customers to pump into the system. Worse than that, the foreclosure rate is really starting to rise now. And that shows that a good many of those people that they did pre-qualifying, you know, for loans at their present income are losing those incomes and are not able to make the payments. So foreclosure rate is on a steep rise, and as well as personal bankruptcies, I think it's 51 million personal bankruptcies last year.
51 million personal bankruptcies?
I mean, that is just an incredible number, Stan.
Well, I think we know, even more frightening is a number of our major corporations, Conesco, I think number three insurance company in the country.
Conseco.
Right. You know, it's just filed for bankruptcy.
Yes, and you know, a lot of people have, I think, excessive faith in insurance companies. I personally think that a lot of them are really on the brink because of, you know, as your listeners may or may not know, the insurance companies have tremendous amounts of liquid funds that they have to put into short-term, long-term, and medium-term investments. A lot of those funds started to go out of conservative investments into the stock market during the previous 10 years, and a lot of those portfolios have lost up to 30-40%. So insurance companies have really been close to the margin, and that's one of the reasons why President Bush decided to bail out the insurance companies by guaranteeing future terrorist events, because literally they are on the margins. And I'm not so sure that any major insurance companies are going to survive a major depression or a war scenario if this country itself gets attacked. So a lot of people have got a lot of money into insurance, a lot of premiums expecting to grow rich in their retirements. The medical insurance cover everything as well as life insurance, and I'm afraid a lot of those insurance companies aren't going to survive what's coming.
And, you know, really it's really so tragic because people cannot understand that these things could happen here in America. But, you know, there's no incidents in all history where you've had a fiat money system, which we have, where that society has actually survived. And, of course, I don't know if you've seen the announcements over in Great Britain, but apparently one of their people in charge of their treasury or the economics just announced that a lot of people are going to have to work, you know, till they're 70, you know, to retire. Otherwise, they're going to, you know, actually face a retirement of poverty. And, you know, just like a bombshell, and the unions are up in arms, but simply saying, no way, and they're going to raise the level of which people can retire, or nearly over there, you could retire at 50 and draw your pension for industry, why you have to go to, you know, to 55, and I think probably government will be 60 or 60. I think government employees are going to have to work till they're 65 to retire and draw the retirement. And this has just happened within a couple of days, because, of course, Great Britain is on the ropes financially. As are so many of our states. I don't know if you've noticed that in Kentucky they've started releasing prisoners there because they don't have the money for the jails. And they're talking here in California, the plans are already on the drawing board for doing the same thing, turning prisoners loose because they don't have the money to keep them in prisons.
Well, you know, they claim in Kentucky, from what I've heard, that they're only releasing nonviolent criminals, but this has not been the pattern everywhere. For example, when I checked latest with people in the tax protester movement, they tell me that there are no tax protesters which are being let out of prison. They are definitely nonviolent, you know, non-threat to anybody but the government, perhaps, but they certainly aren't being let out of prison.
They're just letting the thieves and the muggers and things like that?
Yeah, anybody who hasn't used a gun or a knife in a crime is considered nonviolent, and so they're letting those kinds of people out.
But burglars not, and things like that.
Yeah, right. They're not letting the people out who could be put on parole, who have embezzled or other things, or white-collar type crimes, who could actually make a lot of money and be put on a very strict leash so that they had to pay back their victims, which they do a lot more good paying them back than they would be sitting in prison. But in any case, that's not what our government's doing. And so I suspect, just as there is in the immigration area, a very much different agenda than protecting the American people that we're being told.
Well, I think, you know, when you start turning the prisoners loose, then it creates an increasing tempo of violence, increasing tempo of crime. We may have to cut back on the police. They'll probably do anything, you know, to, convince us we're going to have to just pay more taxes to survive as a society. But as the tempo of violence increases, we move increasingly towards a condition of chaos and crisis. And because it will increase with all these prisoners being released.
Yes, and I'm a believer that our government has long used the principles of agent provocateurs, controlled conflict, and other things in order to justify increased surveillance, increased police powers, just as we have seen with the Homeland Security Act and the Patriot Act, U.S. Patriot Act. And so I don't think this is of any surprise, although, you know, what's interesting is that with all the increasing examples that we have of this kind of activity here and abroad, and through history, World War II was replete with agent provocateurs and controlled and manufactured crises to justify that Hitler used to justify his intervention in other countries, and that the even the West used into intervening and inducing Hitler to strike back so that they could paint him into the box that they did. But with all that history, there's been a great deal of cover-up, and nothing of that gets into the history book. So Americans continue to be extremely naive about the potential of leaders and governments to pull off these kinds of very immoral, provocative acts. But I think those that understand history and understand that conspiracies have always existed realize that this really is nothing new. In fact, I'm just reviewing for next week's World Affairs Brief Barry Chamish's latest book. He's my main source in Israel, and he's got a new book out called Save Israel. I don't know if you've heard about it yet.
No, I haven't.
But, it's a dramatic presentation on the latest evidence he's uncovered between the massive corruption and agent provocateurs and controlled conflict that the Israeli government has been involved in.
Well, of course, he was the one who wrote the book about how the government agents actually killed Rabin, isn't it?
That's correct. Who Murdered Yitzhak Rabin,
right,
was Barry Chamish's most famous book. He still continues to find out more evidence and more whistleblowers coming out of the walls exclaiming that, you know, he's absolutely right. In fact, over it's almost 30% of Israel now believes that the government was responsible for the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin. So unlike here in America, where we're barely able to get 5% to buy into an understanding of the dark side operation and conspiracy and government to form a global government, Barry Chamish almost single-handedly has gotten people in Israel a large percentage, and yet, I mean, to believe and understand the nature of the conspiracy there, and yet they still are powerless to do anything because the government continues to control all the levels of investigation and power and whitewash, and if necessary, do away with key witnesses so that they cannot embarrass the major political leaders who are behind this assassination.
Yes, I remember a point that he made, certainly of the shots fired by the assassinate supposedly severed Rabin's spinal cord, so he was totally paralyzed, and yet, of course, after the shots were fired, he walked for four or five yards to get into the car.
To get into the car. He stands up and walks and bends down and gets into the car. You know, you can't do that with a broken spine.
Right, but of course, maybe things are not as they appear to be. You've probably seen the videos of that.
I have. You know, it's fascinating. Stan, there's so many things about it. You know, there was this amateur videotaping of the event, and you see the bodyguard step back, exposing Rabin to Yigal Amir, who was planted there, and he fires three shots about a meter away from Yitzhak Rabin, all facing his back. And then you hear the guards in Hebrew yelling, "They're blanks. It's a drill. They're blanks. Don't worry, they're blanks." And that's exactly what Yigal Amir said. You know, I was set up and was shooting blanks. So we know that Yitzhak Rabin was not killed in the frame of the video. He gets up, he gets into the car, and all of a sudden he shows up in the hospital and he's got three real bullet wounds in him, one in the side, one in the back, and then one point blank in the front, which goes through and shatters his spine. So
because that's an amazing thing. The fella can fire from the back, and that bullet loops around and comes in from the front. But you know, the trouble is, you know, that when you tell people this, they look at you as if this can't be true. And I suppose until this whole economy falls apart, until people have to see the world as it really is, instead of through the rose-colored glasses that they're visualizing it today, they're not going to understand what's really happening. They're being lied to by a controlled media, and if you can control the media, you can control what people think.
Well, the key element of control in the media is not so much outright lies. Some of that does occur, but most of it is very careful omissions of important pieces of truth. For example, you never hear this kind of evidence about the Rabin assassination being aired. All you heard was that some right-wing radical shot Yitzhak Rabin, and suddenly, like the Kennedy assassination, which I believe was pulled off because of the martyr syndrome, too many conservatives believe that Kennedy was killed because he was going to blow the whistle on the establishment. But that, frankly, has never held water with me, because Kennedy was nothing but a weak yes-man to the establishment, never showed any sign of standing up to them. He was obviously much better off as a martyr, where they could make him famous, name Cape Canaveral after him, and streets all over the nation, and pass all of his legislative agenda. And that's exactly what they tried to do in Israel, and by killing Yitzhak Rabin, who apparently, according to Chamish, was pulling out of the Oslo process, was not going to follow through with the commitments that he had made, and had signed his death warrant. They had to get rid of him and decide we'll make a martyr at the same time. We find that the Shabak, the General Security Services of Israel, had worked for years in the Jewish section of planting their agents among right-wing settlers, recruiting some radical people into, and then inducing them to do radical events. And it turns out that Avishai Raviv, who was works for the Shabak, was the leader of the group Eyal, which Yigal Amir was the so-called assassin was a part of. In other words, here the leader of the right-wing group that they were going to persecute was a Shabak member. He was the one inducing them to attack Rabin and assassinate him. And this has actually come out in Israel. This has hit all of the presses, all of the charges, and they keep delaying the trial of Avishai Raviv so that he cannot be tried. They don't want to get him on the stand, whereby some of this may come out. And this trial has been delayed 9 times now, which is unheard of. They don't want this guy on the stand because they know they're going to have the right to petition witnesses and find out that the government itself induced this whole process.
Well,
very, very fearful.
There's lots of fascinating things going on in the world today, and all we can do is just try to reach as many people as we can. But, I'm encouraged because we are reaching more and more people, through our little network, and other people are doing the same thing. And I'm sure your message is getting out, not only through your World Affairs Brief, but, and other radio appearances that you do. Well, is there anything else we want to cover as far as the economy? You think there's going to be inflation? Do you think that we may see deflation, at least temporarily, until they really turn on those printing presses?
Well, you've got to remember that deflation is going on at the same time as inflation is. Then there's two competing forces running here. It's called stagflation. We had it in the early 70s. It was the first time it happened in America, where we had kind of a inflationary scenario with deflationary things were kind of balancing it out, and the economy was going nowhere. It's the same thing that's happening in Japan now. They've got very strong deflationary forces, and so even though the government is inflating the currency at a whopping 30 or 40% rate, it's still not pulling the government out of the spiral, and I think we could well see the same process. The government is Our own government is spending money like it's going out of style, as if they had unlimited surpluses, and yet it's not affecting the economy. It is affecting the economy. I mean, it's not pulling it out. It's barely keeping it from going down. It's, for example, like the past 10 years when we've had a tremendous decrease in costs in the United States through moving from a high-priced labor economy in the United States to Mexico and then on to China. Almost everything that you buy in the store, everything for sale in the store for Christmas time, has had the Made in China label on it. And frankly, this has been very good for American consumers. I mean, prices have fallen dramatically. The reasons they haven't fallen as far as they would have, if we had true and honest money system, we would have had massive price deflation. we would have been having price deflation on the order of 10 to 15% per year in the United States. Now, we've had almost a zero rate of inflation, actually real rate of inflation, not counting for the skewing of the CPIs, around 3 to 5%. But it would have been a negative, meaning we would have had lowering prices all the way around up to 10 or 15% had it not been for the fact that we've had deflation in there of lowering prices. In other words, if prices still stayed the same, all of our inflation would have showed up as price increases. As it was, we had price increases above 10%, but deflation of less than 10%, and so the net result looks as if we have zero inflation. But it isn't true. The government's inflation is robbing us of the benefit of price deflation. So a lot of those things are what we call hidden things within the economy, hidden victims, hidden processes, negative and positive multipliers that are going on that people can't see. And the government takes the credit for low inflation. But in fact, inflation has been running much higher than people think.
Well, it's interesting. I was reading that the Chinese government, a lot of people are saying it ought to increase the value of its currency, which would mean that their products would be more expensive here, and of course our products would be cheaper over there. And then the communist government says, we're not going to raise the value of our currency. And why should they? I mean, they can simply produce more cheaper as long as their currency is low, and eventually destroy our economy because we cannot possibly hope to compete with them, and even the industries that we have here will soon be driven out of business and will be defeated economically.
Well, there's a lot of complexity going on in terms of the world economy. China is actually having severe problems. They're not keeping ahead of the growth and the demand problems. The growth of the labor field, they're still growing, falling behind in labor, even with the types of investments that have been going on over the past 10 years. China is not well in its banking system. It's got huge portfolios of bad loans and companies that have gone out of business through corruption and other things. They've had a tremendous dislocation within the economy as people have moved into the city to try to compete for these new jobs that have come in through American investment and other foreign countries investing in China. There's been a tremendous dislocation of labor from the rural economies, which are really suffering at this time in China. Now, China is the world's just about ready to surpass Japan, or is surpassing Japan in terms of total percentage of the economy that to take control. And I suspect that within If things weren't going to go down through war and depression, China at the present rate would be equal to the United States probably by the 2012 or so.
Well, they are right today the fourth largest consumer of cars in the world. Now, of course, they're pretty cheap cars. They're certainly not the quality of ours, but they're the fourth largest consumer of cars in the world, and they think that in 2 or 3 years they'll be the second largest consumer of cars anywhere in the world. Which shows, a rapidly growing economy. Now, certainly you may be right. We'll have wars and we'll have really severe dislocations, especially if America is no longer the engine that consumes everything and drives the economies of the rest of the world. But if it ever gets to the point where we can't, we stop buying, where people can't afford to keep buying, or where this whole weight of debt begins to just weigh us down to the point where our whole economy begins to shut down, and then, of course, people don't have the money to buy all these good things, why, of course, then this will be reflected all over the world and plunge the entire world into a depression.
Yes, there is a depression, coming slowly but surely. The negative multiplier is taking effect. People are continuing to lose jobs, and those jobs continue to generate less revenue. Christmas sales, for example, have been very selectively reported in the economic media. They've reported sales from a lot of your major chains, which are only showing slight downturns. But there's a whole host of small businesses that have had a disastrous season. And I want to point out that this is a very important thing within the economy. In the last 10 years, small mom-and-pop niche businesses, even internet businesses, have done very, very well during the holiday season. Now, as people have pulled back, most of the funds have gone to the major advertisers, the Walmarts, the Kmarts, the Targets, and even some of the higher-end stores have done fairly well in this Christmas. There still is a fair amount of money floating around among the middle class and upper middle class. But it's the small businesses, shops on the margin, that have had a disastrous year. So it hasn't been a good Christmas season across the board economically. And that's going to start to show up in lost jobs, lost revenue, lost profits, which will mean a negative multiplier feeding through the economy in this next coming few months.
Well, I'm sure you're right, and certainly as we analyze what's happening across the country, if it weren't for the car sales and the housing sales, the car sales are the only thing in the economy that's keeping our economy from just totally collapsing. In most other fields, manufacturing is really way down.
But I think it's important to remember that the car manufacturers are making very little profit now. They're having to discount so heavily and cut into their profit margins, everyone across the board, and their inventories are so high that they're making very little money. What we're seeing is, as this margin of profit gets much, much smaller, the massive layoffs are inevitable. You just can't keep that up. Right now, they're being able to pay full salaries. But pretty soon we're going to start to see cutting salaries and then massive layoffs, and each one of those is going to really break into the economy now in terms of showing up in less purchasing power around the country.
Now, Ford lost a couple of billion dollars last year. They lost a couple of billion dollars this year. General Motors, I don't know what they're going to do, and certainly over in Europe they're losing money. And, of course, here they've got to pay off something like $29 billion out of their pension fund. So there are all sorts of things. I see that some of the companies that have problems with their pension funds are putting their own company's stock into the pension fund, so they don't have to put any money in there. But, of course, what does that do to the value of their stock? But
right.
Diluted massively.
And the stock is coming down as a result. But this inventory problem in the auto market is something that is a time bomb waiting to explode. Just as we have a huge inventory of houses that have continued to be growing, a lot of people still speculating and building houses, that bubble, like the commercial real estate bubble that happened in the mid-80s, is going to burst again, and you're going to have a lot of housing on the market that just won't be able to be sold. Look at, if you drive down through these auto malls, just acres and acres of brand new cars. Now, those dealers haven't paid for those cars, Stan. Those are owned by the factory, and they usually have a billing relationship, but those car dealers have to move those cars, or within 90 or 120 days, they have to start paying for those, and that's why there's such a big incentive to move those cars. But at some point, even the dealers won't be able to pay for those, and the manufacturers will simply have to start eating it.
And we'll be back here in just a moment with Joel Skousen, and welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there will decide that you're going to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us do what we do 5 hours every day. Because if we can't reach the American people, if the American people don't understand what's going on, if they don't understand the true spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged, and even the spiritual influence on our monetary system, which is the subject of my December newsletter. And I'll have to admit, I learned a great deal writing this newsletter about the various forces at work within our society, and, of course, the spiritual component reflected in those forces. So if you'd like, of course, to have a free copy of any one of our newsletters, we'll be glad to send you one. Our November newsletter actually covered current events, and then, of course, it covered an understanding of what fiat money systems are. And, of course, our December letter will go into this in much greater detail. So if you'd like a free copy of one of our newsletters, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. And then, of course, We, of course, hope that you'll go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, where this and many of our other programs will be archived, and they're up there for 5 or 6 weeks. Then, of course, we hope that you'll tell others about our programs, that you'll copy our newsletters and get other people to begin to read them and to understand what's going on, because all we can do is warn people and hope that they're moved to believe what we say. Because it's going to become increasingly obvious that if you tell them that we're heading towards a financial crisis, they may not want to hear that news, but very, very shortly they're going to look upon you as a prophet and want to know what else is going to happen. And we want you there telling them not only what's happening, but explaining the spiritual component of the battle in which we're engaged. So become informed, help us inform others. The greatest thing that you could do would be to point people towards our Lord Jesus Christ. So right now, of course, remember our website. It's www.radioliberty.com. And our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America truly is at war today. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and our guest this evening is Joel Skousen. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. We're here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. That's 464-8295. We'd love to hear from you. Joel, before we forget about it, and, you know, if I ever, you think I've got to forget, don't hesitate to remind me. How can people get your World Affairs Brief?
The World Affairs Brief, the best way to do it is to go and look on my website, which is www.joelskousen.com. That's spelled J-O-E-L-S-K-O-U-S-E-N. All is written as one word, .com. Or if they don't have access to the Internet, they can get free samples of the hard copy of the World Affairs Brief by calling my office number, 801-224-4746. And I also have copies of Barry Chamish's book. If anyone's interested in these very fine books on Israel, they can call me about those. We sponsored Barry Chamish on a tour year or so ago to explain these very interesting and sad goings-on in the Middle East, and there is some tremendous information that can be had about the globalist influence and control over the Israeli government, why they're not working in the best interest of the Israeli people, in the same way that a Bush administration is not really working in the best interest of the American people.
Well, if Barry does get over here, why, please give me a call. I'd love to get him onto all of our programs, because I think he's got a great deal to say, and it's a message we want to get out to the American people as well, because, of course, it's the same forces that are working in both Israel and in the United States, not trying to solve the problems, but, of course, trying to compound the problems.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things about that, Stan, is that we have a great deal of information that came out of the 1980s from the numerous whistleblowers that told about dark side government activities, the drug importation, the INS and other immigration scandals, and the assassinations worldwide, the dealing with arms and terrorists, helping them out. But, you know, we've had hardly any whistleblowers from the 90s and almost none now. In other words, our government or the dark side elements of government have got so much control over the judicial process and being able to shut down whistleblowers and threaten them, as well as weed out people of principle in many of these organizations. For example, dark side government activities no longer have to use regular military pilots and other things to do their dirty work for them and threaten them to keep them silent. They have now so much money from black operations, they're able to have their own fleets of helicopters and special planes and aircraft and pilots. In other words, the corruption within these dark side elements have grown so that we hardly hear anything anymore. Here we have a Bush administration that claims to be Christian conservative, still operating the same evil dark side activities, and yet we just don't have any. I mean, they're getting so much better, we don't have any whistleblowers blowing the whistle on them. We have to look at the some other indications to know that the Bush administration is essentially controlled by the same people who are running the Clinton administration. But what I was mentioning is that in Israel, Barry Chamish is having just the opposite effect. He's getting more and more people coming out of the woodwork from government as his story continues to get out, and he's getting more and more witnesses, evidence, and testimony of dark side activities. So it is a mini scenario of watching conspiracy in operation, watching our own globalist leaders manipulate the forces over there in Israel, and it helps us have evidence of the corruption with our own government, the lies within our own Bush administration, as we see how they play out in Israel. So I highly recommend these books, especially the new one by Barry Chamish called Save Israel, talking about the insiders working in Israel, trying to undermine it and keep the war going rather than solve the peace process. And of course, this explains why the Bush administration continues to push for a Palestinian state. It's as if they said, well, we know that Osama bin Laden and the Taliban are guilty of 9/11, and so we're going to push to make sure that they have their own sovereign state so that any Afghans fighting against them will make sure that they can't stop them from forming a sovereign state, because all good terrorists need to have their own independent sovereign base of relationships. And that's essentially what the U.S. is telling Israel. And the so-called conservative prime minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, is taking that very same stance. He is for a Palestinian state. He is beginning to purge his own Likud party. That's their equivalent of the Republican Party over there. Purge his party, saying that no one can serve in the new government as a minister unless they buy into his doctrine of creating a Palestinian state for Arafat.
And of course, Arafat is a lifelong terrorist. I mean, he was, behind so many of the terrorist attacks through the years. And had it not been that we rescued him from Lebanon in the 1980s, the Reagan administration did send him over to Tunisia. If it weren't that we were constantly funding him, and he had a great cheering section in the American press. I mean, Arafat would have been deposed a long time ago. I don't think he represents the average Palestinian. I think he represents the American establishment.
That's correct, and we now find one of the biggest scandals is the Gino Sar scandal in Israel. We find out now that Yossi Gino Sar was the deputy chief of affairs in the Shabak, or the General Security Services. There was a major scandal, and he had to be removed from office. And what happened? And we find out that under the Perez and Barak administrations, that he went to work as a secret liaison between Yasser Arafat and the Israeli government, and he helped Yasser Arafat set up his secret bank accounts in Switzerland to hide the millions of dollars that Arafat was siphoning off from the Palestinian Authority.
So we were sending him, of course.
That's right, and part of that was the U.S. aid that was coming, approximately $175 million a year, going to Yasser Arafat and the Palestinian Authority, and he was siphoning them off. But it was a major leader in the Labor Party, part of the Israeli government, that was secretly assisting Arafat in siphoning off these funds, that with the full knowledge of the entire pro-Oslo Labor Party crowd who was running the government at the time. And this is a huge scandal. It's known and admitted now by the government. But they're saying, just like George Bush said when he came into office, it's past history. Sharon administration, who should be jumping up and down in anger with this, is not prosecuting this in any form. So this is a major scandal and indicates the high level of corruption. I mean, this is high treason.
Well, they call it bipartisan treason. I think that's what we call it here. Let's go to Jerry calling from Los Angeles. Hi, Jerry. Do you have a question or comment?
I found the conversation very interesting, and I just like to relate a experience. It's just an internet experience, I don't want to have to go through my stars and stripes as far as my faith to Israel, I've read recently that the United States is potentially going to give Israel $14 billion in aid. And I went to the Jerusalem Post to look for this information, and I wrote an email saying, you know, where is this information? You know, this is the Jerusalem Post. You know, I looked to the JerusalemPost.com, for information on Israel, you know, and immediately, and I haven't been able to access their internet site.
I don't think that they're going to give $14 billion to Israel in any way. Do you think there's any possibility of that? Have you heard anything at all about that, Joel?
Well, you know, U.S. Congress has kind of had a de facto agreement that they give the same amount of money to Egypt as they do to Israel to so-called keep the balance of terror going in the Middle East conflict. But the traditional amount has been $3 billion each per year, so I don't know where the $14 billion comes from, but that's a massive increase.
Yeah.
Now,
I don't really believe that's true, and I don't believe everything I read on the Internet, Jerry, so
I'd be very
skeptical.
I'm not talking about Internet hearsay. I'm talking about, this is well-established. You know, I think it's even been mentioned in some of the major newspapers.
Well, if you get me one of those news, would you find that?
They're talking about $14 billion.
Well, you find that
$4 billion in grants for the military for the Iraq situation, and for broken provinces the Bush administration has. And all I was trying to do was, trying to find out more about this.
Well, I would suggest, Nathan, you look, find that article, you send it to me.
This is very easy.
Fine. You find that, you get it to me. I got to go to another call here, but thanks so much. Let's go to, let's go to Nathan here. Hi, Nathan. Nathan, are you there?
Hi, good evening, gentlemen. I agree with basically everything that you're saying tonight, except there was one thing that stood out a little while ago, and I was hoping you could clarify it. You were talking about China, and you were saying, trade with China is a good thing for the American consumer.
Oh, a good thing for the American consumer, but not a moral thing or a right thing. I think that might be a better way to phrase it, okay?
Okay, well, I mean, I have no prejudice against anyone or any nation. It just seems to me, though, that as China is governed by the governing system that it's governed by, as opposed to a more godly form of government that upholds the laws of God, it seems to me that it would be financing our own subjugation. Now, I don't want to cast aspersion on every single Chinese business or I understand that there's a lot of trade with China right now in San Francisco and in Chinatown. It seems to me, though, that if we're going to have this kind of trade with China, we should be encouraging its transformation into a whole other China indeed, as I believe prophetically that it will change into a whole other China indeed in the future, in the Messianic age. I think we should start encouraging it now.
All right. Was that your point?
I guess you cleared it up for me, but maybe Dr. Skousen could clear it up a little more. Thank you, gentlemen. Otherwise, it's a great show tonight.
Thank you so much.
It.
Bye-bye.
Well, I'm in complete agreement with the caller. When I mentioned that even though it may be good economically in terms of lower prices, it certainly isn't good for national defense because we know that the Chinese government is using all of that trade to finance a military revolution there and to continue to subjugate its people. In fact, I think even though I believe in free trade, I believe that for national security reasons that you can restrict a trade to communist nations who will in fact use that trade to destroy you someday. And certainly that trade involves sensitive military technology, which both Bush administrations have been involved in the same kind of military transfers that the Clinton administration was involved in. In fact, George Bush Sr. started this by allowing Chinese military people to have free run of all the top secret areas within use aircraft and Lockheed Martin and other military industrial factories. And the Bush administration has given exemptions through the Commerce Department for the same type of Chinese technology trade and advancement, all the while they're proclaiming that this is a potential threat to America, Rumsfeld is playing games with the words about, you know, after the spy plane incident, he's going to restrict Chinese military liaison, and now he's got them wide open again. So it was just a little bit of window dressing for people. But clearly we have an obligation to try to foment liberty and use what trade advantages we have as a lever to encourage more liberty.
Well, we're not doing that. We're not insisting that they liberalize, that they treat the Christians. In fact, we basically do everything we can to build up their government and to maintain this ruthless, tyrannical regime in power. And as you say, to help them finance building up their military, which will one day be used against us. And none of this makes any logical sense unless, as you point out so well, there indeed is another agenda behind what's going on today that the American people are not being told about. You do not finance your potential enemies and build up their military power. You don't feed a tiger meat hoping it's going to become a vegetarian. And yet that's exactly the policy we have towards communist China today.
Well said, yes.
All right, fine. Well, I share your concern about all of these things as they're coming down the line. But I'm really very concerned about our domestic economy, because I think that as this economy contracts, there's going to be a lot of civil unrest in this country.
Well, certainly we have an over-specialization problem in the economy where not enough people have the ability to revert to a more basic type of employment. As I pointed out in a couple of briefs, or a couple of weeks ago in the World Affairs Brief, that if you look around you at what people do for a living, as opposed to the 1930s, for example, where everybody was doing basic, very real-life, useful things, most of the things that people around you are engaged in labor-wise are very optional. They're very good in a high-paced, sophisticated, specialized economy to have this division of labor, but when we have a contraction as it is, people need to revert back to more basic types of employment that are more useful. Just so many people out there selling essential or non-essential services that can be done away with. So while a great many people are still employed, employment is still only running about 8%, it doesn't start to get serious till it gets over 10% unemployment. But in any case, there's a greater potential than ever before in the history of the United States for a contraction of the labor market, because so much of the labor that we've hired people for is non-essential and can be done away with. So as soon as the economy starts to reverse as it is now and contracting, it can easily contract very, very rapidly because of the fact that so many people are doing nice-to-have things.
And, of course, the other thing is that so many of our service jobs are being shipped overseas. So many of our answering service and telephone service, one of my friends lives up in Idaho, and he had, I think, problem with one of his public utilities, whether it was electricity or something else. He called, got a very nice fellow on the line, and said, oh, yes, they'll be working on that, but I can't tell you exactly when. And my friend asked him where he lived, and he lived in Calcutta, India, and he was answering the phone for one of the local, I believe it was the local utility from Calcutta.
Isn't that incredible?
Well, it's not. I mean, what they're doing is they're transferring even many of our service jobs overseas. And
well, the United States, Stan, is still allowing the import of hundreds of thousands of high-tech workers in this quota system to fulfill American jobs here. And
that's a little, that in part is because we don't have people in many instances in the high-tech industries to fulfill these positions. We've so dumbed down so many of our people.
Yes,
and of course,
we do now. We've got a surplus now because of the layoffs that have occurred in high-tech. We've got a surplus, and they are still allowing this window of guest workers to come into the United States to fill slots.
But they'll work for less. That's what
true.
It's all about. And they're driving down our wages. They're driving down our living standards. And, of course, how can the American worker possibly compete with the people over in communist China? And yet that is what's happening, and they're still encouraging our industry to move offshore and actually subsidizing it to go. That, of course, is the amazing thing people do not understand. We have transferred almost the majority of our industry out of this country.
Yes, and it will come back to haunt us. There aren't any shoe manufacturers in the United States. Who's going to manufacture shoes in a war situation? when we don't have the trade and shipping potential because communist China suddenly becomes an enemy.
And of course, you know, the berets that are green berets or are black berets, I guess maybe they were the Rangers or something, they were ordering the berets, but were they being made here for our military in the United States? No, they were coming from communist China.
Well, you know, the country could gear up over time as we did in World War II, but I believe that the next war is going to begin with a nuclear preemptive strike on America. And because of that, there just won't be the ability to gear up, and we'll be fighting a survival battle. Could have famine for a couple of years here because of the lack of electricity through a EMP strike that would precede a nuclear strike. At least that's Soviet doctrine.
No, what is that? Is that an attack?
A nuclear electromagnetic pulse. High altitude nuclear weapons placed approximately every 500 miles, blanketing the United States so that it pulls down all the electrical grid and destroys much of the computer microchip in most equipment. It's going to be very, very difficult to operate going back to a 19 or 1870s economy.
Well, I think it's going to be an exciting time. Let's go to Herman, who's calling us from Carmel. Hi, Herman. How are you doing tonight?
Good evening. I remember a quote that always used to be in the Mother Earth magazines, founded by Shuttleworth, and they used to have an economics update, which was really great, and then later when it was homogenized, they took it out. But it always said this, better 20 years too early than one day too late.
Yeah, it's like Gary North's statement about don't be on the last train out.
Right.
You know, if you shoot for the last train out, you're going to be too late.
Well, of course, what we're doing, as you well know, Herman, because I know you listen to our programs regularly, is trying to get at least our listeners to understand that we're moving into difficult times, as far as finances are concerned, as far as the possibility of increasing diseases. But our plea is, of course, get prepared economically, physically, but also spiritually. And I know that you would concur with that. At least we'll have some people who understand what's going on, and hopefully they'll then be able to help others. But they've got to be able to help themselves before they can help others.
Quick question, Joel. I know you're from Utah. Do you believe that the churches will be an important institution if these times of crisis do come?
I really do, especially because I think in the type of attack that we're coming, and even before then, when we reach a real economic low cycle, I don't think government's going to be able to fulfill their promises of working through all the problems. But more so when there's social unrest and when the fabric of society comes undone, as would happen in a nuclear preemptive strike, even if it were only on military targets, there would be a tremendous amount of dislocation and social unrest, especially in the major metropolitan areas. And I see, when I look at FEMA plans, for example, in a nuclear emergency or even a chemical or biological attack, they fully intend to simply relocate people by force out of major cities and put them in the homes of individuals in rural areas. And that's a recipe for disaster. It's what the Soviets did in the communization of private property in Moscow, and it caused a tremendous amount of hatred, social unrest, and violence in reaction. But I think because people will tend to migrate away from major population areas during major crises because of the social unrest factor, that they'll descend upon whole cities, and it's going to be the churches that have the resources and the capacity. Even if they aren't united, they have the capacity to become united very quickly. Especially, for example, that's one of the reasons I moved from Oregon to this Utah area, is because, with the Mormon influence here, they're very preparedness-oriented, and they have an alternate infrastructure that is capable of helping hold the fabric of society together. People are just used to looking for, if the state isn't doing it right, they look to the church leadership for doing something right. And that could have a very stabilizing influence in tough times. So that's one of the reasons why I moved here.
Do they still have large food supplies? I know traditionally the Mormons always had a tremendous stockpiles of food. Are they still doing that?
They are. In fact, there's been a recent encouragement to people to get out of debt and to make sure they've got their full year's supply. Frankly, you know, I've done a lot of personal research here and found that probably less than 20% of Mormons really have a full year's supply. But that's a heck of a lot better than the country as a whole.
I'll say it is. Well,
and the church itself has huge warehouses. It has church farms where they have, they grow apples, pears, and everything. They have their own canneries and distribution centers. So at least there is some level of preparedness beyond which government, and which brings me to my basic point. If Homeland Security were really a serious issue with the Bush administration, they wouldn't be trying to do it all with federal dollars and huge bureaucracies. What they do is say, get prepared people. Everyone should have high security rooms, shelters. In case there's nuclear war, you should have a gas mask. They should be saying you should have a year's supply of food and water and other things. And giving out information, encouraging people in a self-help basis and a community and church basis to prepare. But they're not interested, really, in preparing American people.
No, and that's, because of that, there will, of course, if these things come to pass, there will be chaos.
Yes.
And then we'll be totally dependent upon FEMA. Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Out of time, Herman, do you have anything else you want to say?
Well, just let's all pray for provision and protection, and pray for our leaders.
God bless you. Good night, Herman.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. And so I want to thank you so much for being with us, Joel. It's always a pleasure, and I'll let you go. And remember, that's worldaffairsbrief.com, 801-224-4746. Good night. God bless.
All right. Good night, Stan.
And, of course, this is Dr. Stan asking you to pray for America. And certainly pray for our leaders, pray for our ministers, and please remember to pray for our ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow at the same time, Dr. Stan, goodbye, and may the Lord be with you.
The DARPA, you know, that emblem that they had on their website, I downloaded that, but they changed it about a week ago to all text. Right? So,
hang on to it. I have a copy, but maybe a collector's item one of these days. Is that for me?
No.
Is that not for me?
It's not for you. For Dale.
Oh, okay.
Make sure he doesn't get away.